This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Bill Schaefer, the host of the channel for today's session. Today we'll be talking to Todd McGowan about his new book, Emancipation After Hegel, Achieving a Contradictory Revolution, which argues that an encounter with intractable contradiction lies at the heart of Hegel's philosophy, and that a proper understanding of his dialectical method could transform our understanding of the possibilities of contemporary politics. It is therefore a work that seeks to demonstrate the urgent relevance of intellectual history to problems of the present. Todd McGowan, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for coming. Okay. So, Todd, I wonder if you could begin this interview by telling us a bit about your background and how it led you to writing this book.
The first time I read Hegel was in graduate school. So I just had, I had a sense, I don't know where the sense came from, that Hegel was important. And so I asked my dissertation director if I could do an independent study reading Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit. And that sort of took me off on the path to Hegel. And then I guess from that, not that early, but pretty early on, I had the idea that I wanted to write a book on Hegel. And I'd say over the last maybe 10 years, I've been slowly accumulating little pieces of it, like chapters or just little sections. And then about maybe 3-4 years ago, I decided to put it all together. And that's how the book came about.
Okay. So my first question is about the difference between contradiction and difference, because at a time when the celebration of difference has become mandatory in leftist theorizing, your book tries to show that the logic of contradiction emerging from Hegel's dialectic provides a much better basis for a leftist politics than an ontology of difference. And of course, as I'm sure we all know, the joyful valorization of difference in theory is almost always accompanied by a total rejection of Hegel's totalizing tendencies. So I wonder if you can give us an initial impression of the difference between difference and contradiction as you understand it, and the stakes of that distinction for contemporary theory.
Sure. So I guess I associate difference mostly with Deleuze, but also, as you're saying, it goes far beyond that. It comes from Derrida, and it also sort of infiltrated just almost every aspect of contemporary theory. And my idea is that difference is always I even think it's almost always an ideological move away from contradiction, so contradiction makes apparent the way in which the signifying order or the social order is always at odds with itself, and differences can always at least the idea of differences means that they can always coexist in peace. Ideally, they can coexist peacefully. I think that's what the philosophers of difference. That's their idea, that there would be a peaceful coexistence of difference. And I think that for me, that's exactly what's ideological about it. And contradiction shows how there's always this tension within any social order within any structure. And that tension is, I think, the site of a radicality, like a site of where openings can exist, where we can discover what is repressed by the social order or the signifying order. And that's what difference doesn't really do. Difference always keeps, there's always, you can always add more differences. And contradiction doesn't lend itself to that adding of more. And, you know, you mentioned Hegel's, the critique of him as a totalizing philosopher. And I think, to me, that's actually what's most interesting and maybe best about him, because his point is it's only when we think the totality that we make apparent the contradiction. So the way in which philosophers of difference avoid the totality is, to me, part and parcel of their avoidance of contradiction.
Okay. So you decisively reject the schema of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, which has dominated explications of Hegel's dialectic, so much so that I thought your book might have been called Against Synthesis. Can you tell you why you view this familiar schema as a fundamental error?
Yeah, I like that title. Maybe I should have chosen that title. That's funny. I don't know why I got the idea that I would take this, I guess because it's so popular, that I took this idea of thesis, antithesis, synthesis as a jumping off point for my, I think the first chapter is basically a refutation of that idea. And first of all, Hegel never uses these terms. So it's a pretty big thing that people, this tripartite idea that's most associated with him, he never says. And I think the other problem, the main problem with it for me is that it brings the idea of synthesis is the idea of a things working out together without any disruption. And to me, the whole point of Hegel's philosophy is that things never just work out perfectly, that the disruption is in fact part of the way in which things have to work out, that the way things don't, I mean, just to put it, maybe this is too cute, but the way things don't work out is always part of the way things do work out.
Right. So your reasons for rejecting synthesis are somewhat similar to your reasons for your hesitation to embrace difference, in that it suggests a kind of false harmony.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's interesting because I think philosophers of difference would themselves reject synthesis, but I think both of them, that's a really nice point I think that you made. I think both of them are doing the same thing. I think you're right. Both of them have this, a kind of false harmony that is associated with them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I suppose one of the main points of inspiration for philosophers of difference is the work of Nietzsche, who invoked a war of all against all. So I suppose at least at a rhetorical level, they are themselves decisively rejecting harmony. But your point that would be that they don't have a logic to pursue that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Nietzsche, it's funny because I think Nietzsche, that idea of a war of all against all, you know, and that the whole Nietzschean notion of the differences, but tension within the differences. I think the difference is that for Hegel, the idea of contradiction means that the struggle is equally within. And I mean, I think you could say that about Nietzsche too, but I think Nietzsche relies on some form of an external enemy, and in a way that Hegel doesn't. And so part of one of the things I talk about in the book is the way in which this idea of the friend-enemy distinction, popularized most by Carl Schmitt, is something that really I think Hegel's decisively against, because for him, it's always the enemy within, not the external enemy, that's the real problem. And that's what the real struggle is always with.
Right. Yeah, I had a question right towards the end about that friend-enemy distinction. So we'll probably get to come back to that if we have time.
Okay, good.
Your book is full of negative-sounding words like intractability, obstacle, and failure. You seem to be suggesting the theory should be less concerned with evoking open flows or lines of flight than with recognizing internal barriers and articulating the necessity of a certain kind of failure, like my failure to say necessity there. Superficially, this emphasis on limits and failure might seem more consonant with a conservative project than an emancipatory one. Can you talk about the virtues of failure in relationship to the possibility of what you call a contradictory revolution?
Sure. One of the things, one of the words that you mentioned there is obstacle. And I think for me, obstacle is a great point of, that really make a great word to make the point that I want to make about about failure and its emancipatory potential, because obstacle is there's a German word Anstoß, which is used by the philosopher who is right before Hegel, Johann Wolfgang von Fichte. And Fichte's point about Anstoß is that it's both an obstacle and an impetus. So the German word has the double meaning. And so Hegel loves words that mean one thing and their opposite. And I think that's, for me, that's what's true about failure, limit, obstacle, that these are the things that actually create an opening and are the sites of possibility. And it's only by seeing them that we can create that we can actually see different open political possibilities that we otherwise wouldn't be able to see. So that limit or failure it's also the site of something that's very generative in a way that, like, just a pure openness would not be generative, because it ends up just reproducing the same, or it reproduces something that's consistent with the logic of what's already there. But the limit or the failure is a point at which we see an opening to the outside.
Yep. So that would be similar to the way that the phenomenology works, in that each shape of consciousness meets a point of failure eventually, and it's precisely that drives it on to a new standard.
That's exactly right. Like a new way of failing. That's what I like about it. The thinking about politics, if you think about it instead in terms of failing rather than in terms of success, I think it all of a sudden opens up a whole other kind of way of thinking, and it gets out of what I see as the capitalist trap, which is constantly trying to find looking to some better tomorrow that will deliver us from any kind of suffering or all dissatisfaction. And I think Hegel's philosophy is pretty interesting because for the reason that it shows us how the dissatisfaction is in some way constitutive of our being, and that we have to in some way reconcile ourselves to that. And if we don't, we end up creating, I don't know if I maybe we'd call it an excess dissatisfaction if you keep trying to get this perfect satisfaction. So I think failure is a way, like focusing on the limit or the failure is a way to avoid the excess dissatisfaction that comes from not doing that.
So there's a kind of implied anti-utopianism, which would be like a caveat against a certain kind of violence.
I think that's right. I think that, you know, Hegel was very critical of the Reign of Terror in the French, even though he was very much in favor of the French Revolution, he was also very critical of the Reign of Terror. And I think his diagnosis is that it's the very utopian dimension of it that creates the violence. And I think that that's right. I think that, you know, of all the thinkers in the history of philosophy or in intellectual history, I think Hegel's maybe the most anti-utopian. That for him, it's utopian thinking is really the path to disaster.
Yeah, and which is a kind of paradox in that we think of him as being the philosopher who almost seems to identify himself with the absolute, which some would take as the attainment of a kind of utopia. But you're arguing that's exactly what he rejects.
Exactly what he rejects, right? That the absolute is instead the absolute confrontation with an intractable limit. So, I mean, he even says that at the end of the Phenomenology and Absolute Knowing section. He says that philosophy or spirit is that's what he calls thinking or thought. Spirit knows itself and it knows its limit. So even in the Absolute Knowing section, he explicitly says that absolute knowing means knowing a limit, not surpassing all limits into some utopia of thought or utopia of or social utopia.
Right. So we'll be coming back to the limit later when I ask a question about Hegel's relationship to Kant. But my next question is about, perhaps surprisingly to some listeners, about love. So you argue that the notion of love is central to the development of Hegel's philosophy, and that it was never really abandoned by him, but rather ends up being, as it were, transubstantiated and incorporated into his logic of contradiction. And in perhaps the most potentially scandalous note of your book, you claim that Hegel's particular way of declaring that God is dead, as opposed to Nietzsche's much more famous version of that, demonstrates the singularity and superiority of Christianity as a religion of love in relationship to other religions. Can you talk a little bit about the role of love in Hegel's thought and how it leads you to defend what some might view as a form of Christian supremacy?
Yeah, I do have a form of Christian. I mean, you know, supremacy, God, I wouldn't have said that, but I do think that Christianity has a kind of insight that other religions don't. But I think other religions can, I don't think it precludes them. I think that there's a way in which they can, you know, they can with a little, you know, hint from Christianity can come to the same point. But I did, back to the idea of love, I think that love, I think I say this in the book, that love's the point at which Hegel breaks from Kant and this idea. So he, in his early life, up until about 1800, he was immorally or ethically, he was a Kantian. And there's this moment when he writes these little short things about love. And he for him, love is the thing that allows him to break from Kant and the idea of Kantian duty. And he, and an ethic of love, for Hegel, means seeing oneself in absolute otherness. And that for him is an ethic that trumps the Kantian ethic of duty. And then that's also how he identifies the concept later, that the concept in the science of logic is precisely what only becomes what it is through its transition or movement into absolute otherness. So I think there's a nice, interesting way in which love, I like the way you said that, becomes transubstantiated into the concept. I think that's exactly how I would put it.
Okay, and that provides a good segue to my next question, which is about Kant. Hegel described his philosophy as absolute idealism and rejected any fixed division between thought and things in themselves. This stands in stark contrast to Kant's call to limit the exercise of reason to the sphere of experience, a necessity demonstrated to his satisfaction by certain encounters with unavoidable contradiction at the very limits of reason and the limits of time and space. For many, this refusal to acknowledge the point at which reason can go no further would mark Hegel's thought as a regression to a form of pre-critical and pre-Kantian rationalism. You insist, however, that Hegel goes decisively beyond Kant, in a completely unparalleled and unprecedented sense. Can you tell us how a philosophy that invokes the absolute can nonetheless be construed as resolutely post-Kantian?
Sure. And that's a good summary, I think, of what the standard critique of Hegel is. And he has this great line where he says, only way to understand a limit is to always be beyond, to also be beyond the limit. So his idea is that Kant is kind of cheating when he tries to identify the limits of reason, because the only way to identify those limits is to already in some way have be beyond them and see them from the other side. And so Hegel's point is that not that there are no limits, but that we can identify the limits, and by identifying the limits, we can think. That's what he thinks thinking absolutely is. And so part of what he does, and I think this is I said before that the turn from Kant to Hegel is a turn on love, and that's true for his ethical and practical philosophy. But in terms of his theoretical philosophy, it's really on this idea of the limit that Hegel moves beyond Kant. And what he does is he looks at what Kant sees as the absolute, what he calls antinomies of pure reason, and Hegel identifies these as the problems that reason runs in, not just that reason runs into, but that actual being itself runs into. And so his idea is that if reason is able to apprehend these things, there must be some way in which these are ontological structures already, that there has to be some kind of antinomy, contradiction, some problem in being itself in order for us to be able to apprehend it. And so that's why he doesn't think that we can, that limit of the not being able to think the thing in itself. His idea is that, well, the way that we think has to be impacted by the thing in itself. And so understanding, looking, moving from thought to the thing in itself is Hegel thinks, possible precisely because of this impact of the thing in itself on thought. That you can't, how could it be that the way things are in themselves has no impact on the way that we think? Hegel thinks, of course, it has to have an impact. And we can diagnose that through what we're able to think and what we're not able to think.
So in a sense, the point at which Kant would have us stop thinking is exactly the point at which Hegel starts, which would be at the limit.
That's really well put. Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Okay. So my next question is about the subject. So you affirm the importance of the Hegelian proposition that substance is subject. And at the same time, although the name of Lacan is mentioned very sparingly in this particular book, it is clear that you are also constantly engaged as a theorist with the Lacanian problem of the subject. Here again, you seem to deliberately swim against the tide of contemporary theory as it has been formulated in the wake of post-structuralism, which tends to proudly repudiate or bypass the concept of the subject. Can you tell us how you believe the concept of the subject has been misconstrued by so many and why it should be reinstalled as a central reference point for contemporary theory?
Yeah, so I think that the way that I'm uncomfortable with the term post-structuralism because that the thinkers that are post-structuralists never use that term themselves, but I understand what it refers to.
I get that. I agree.
Yeah. Yep. So, but those thinkers, so Derrida, Deleuze, Foucault, let's say, the rejection of subject, I think, is a rejection of the subject of mastery. That is a subject that imposes itself on the world. And fair enough. I think that we should reject that for sure. But the point is that, and this is Hegel's point, that there's always two sides to subjectivity, that there's this subject of mastery that's trying to impose itself on the world, but there's also the subject that's split. So there's and you referenced Lacan. So the split for Lacan would be the split between the subject of the subject of the enunciation and the subject of the statement. That is, I who am speaking, and then the I who, if I say I am speaking, the I of that's in the sentence. So the difference between those, or you could even think the difference between the unconscious and consciousness and within subjectivity, like that kind of split. That for psychoanalysis is theorized that way. For Hegel, it's theorized as the difference between the subject that has mastery over the world and then this subject that's imposed upon. And so, that idea that the way he says it, the idea that the substance is subject, is that everything that we think of as substantial is always split. So that's the idea that everything that we would take as an authority can't really be an authority. So that's what I think that's what he means by substance. Is substance is an authority. Substance is something that we think is solid ground. And if you say substance is subject, what you mean by that is that everything that would be solid ground is actually split and divided against itself, which means you can't rely on that. You have to call that into question as well. So I think there's a way in which substance is subject or subject is a license to continually questioning. And I think the rejection of subjectivity it fits in with the philosophy of difference, I think. And there's a way in which that doesn't allow the same kind of questioning because it doesn't get at this fundamental divide within us. And I think that's what Hegel's getting at, that we have to accept this divide within us and this divide within any authority that we come in contact with.
Okay, and you provided another nice link to my next question by mentioning the unconscious. So to take the discussion of the subject a little further, you argue that Freud, in a sense, and I hope I'm not overstating this, completes the dialectic, even if he barely ever engaged with Hegelian philosophy, by thinking the one thought that Hegel came, as it were, too early to think, which is the thought of the unconscious. One thing that occurs to me that some readers might wonder is, not readers, listeners, isn't this kind of begging the question? Why wouldn't the intrinsic dynamic of the dialectic itself lead Hegel to discover the unconscious before Freud? And on the other hand, in a kind of reverse maneuver, you also claim that Hegel's philosophy demonstrates that Freud's couch and the talking cure need not be the only royal road to an adequate theory of the subject, and that the exercise of dialectical reason by a philosopher in an armchair can also provide a viable pathway. And this might seem like a proposal that would distress psychoanalysts. So can you talk a little bit about Hegel's own failure to articulate the concept of the unconscious and the way you link the dialectic to Freud and Lacan?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel like, why doesn't he himself discover the unconscious? So Schelling uses the term. And so it could be that his rivalry with Schelling makes him not able to discover it. But of course, the problem is that the Freudian unconscious is something far from Schelling's unconscious. And I think it is true that Freud, if he wasn't listening to other people, would not have discovered the unconscious. And so I feel like you kind of caught me in a little thing where I do think that Hegel moves beyond Freud in the sense that he does point out how we can uncover the unconscious within our own thinking. But the fact that he couldn't discover it is crucial. I think that he couldn't discover it because it requires always another person and this I think is true in a very commonsensical way. Like other people, when we're talking to them, they hear our slip and they see our unconscious, or they just look at us in the way that we talk and they see our gestures and our unconscious makes it manifest itself in these interactions. And when Freud's listening to patients, it becomes overtly manifest, and also overtly manifested, and also that he's paying attention to dreams. And that's just something Hegel, because he shares the prejudices of a lot of philosophers, that he didn't think anything about dreams. And I think that's probably where Freud said that dreams were the royal road to the unconscious. And it's probably true that if he wasn't thinking about dreams, he wouldn't have had the idea of the unconscious. And so I think Hegel, just because he had the philosopher's prejudice, I don't think he could come up with it. But it is a good question. Like, why didn't he discover it? And I guess that's my best answer, is that he had the philosopher's prejudice and he wasn't interacting with other people in the way Freud was, which created a limit for what he could uncover.
Okay. My next question is about Marxism and your relationship to it. So Marx famously announced the need to invert Hegel in order to arrive at dialectical materialism. Although my understanding is that phrase was used much more eagerly by Engels than Hegel. But as far as I know, even Slavoj Žižek, whose precedent you acknowledge as crucially making your own work possible, continues to describe himself as both a Marxist and a materialist, even if with increasing reservations. Can you tell us a little about your own apparent reluctance to identify with any form of Marxism, no matter how revised, and your apparent readiness to defend absolute idealism from a leftist point of view?
Sure. This is actually, I had a discussion with Slavoj right after my book came out about this very question and about why he insists on still calling himself a Marxist. And, you know, his point was, I think it was a good point. His point was, Hegel doesn't have any of the analysis of Capital that Marx does. And that's just true. So that's something. So I do share some of Marx's analysis of Capital. I think it's right. I just, not enough that I would call myself a Marxist. And I think it comes down to maybe this question of materialism versus idealism. And I feel like that for Hegel, his notion of absolute idealism doesn't mean material doesn't matter. And in fact, Slavoj calls him, his book on Hegel called Less Than Nothing, the subtitle of it mentions the shadow of dialectical materialism. So he sees Hegel tries to reread him as a dialectical materialist. But I guess for me, what Hegel means by absolute idealism is that that the relationship between ideas and matter is always dialectical. So the notion that you could say one has priority over the other for him doesn't make any sense. And I think I agree with that. I think it doesn't make any sense to insist on being a materialist. I don't think, because one of the things that Hegel shows is the power of ideas to change history. And interestingly, I think Marx actually shows that too, right? Like in some way, the whole Marxist project is an attempt to inject ideas into the material movement of history in order to change it. Like if Marx didn't think that ideas couldn't change history, he wouldn't have written. So I feel like my claim would be even Marx isn't that always totally a materialist. But why I don't identify with Marxism is because I think that Marx has this idea of healing that I don't think Hegel has, that his idea of getting out of history, or I think he puts it like we could get out of prehistory and into actual history, but that notion for him is a history without any more contradiction. And to me, that's a really dangerous idea, that if we think we can get out of contradiction, that's what paves the way to any kind of, or any kind of violence, but especially the worst kind of violence. Like I want to get rid of the thing that's causing the contradiction. And that can be a bunch of people too. And I think that's what happened in the history of Marxism. And I think it's attributable to his theoretical, what I would call his theoretical error.
So you have a license to murder in order to bring about the utopia again. So it's again a note of anti-utopianism.
Right. I think it's, and you know what? I mean, Merleau-Ponty even has this, it's a very fascinating book called Humanism and Terror, in which he says, you probably know it, in which he says, look, because of what Stalin's going to produce, the gulag is justified and the show trials are justified. So, and I don't disagree with that. Like, if you really thought we could overcome contradiction, why not? I mean, like, okay, it costs like whatever, a few thousand, 100,000 lives, but it'll create a world in which life is so much better for those people, then maybe okay. But so I think, but if you don't think that's possible, which I don't think is possible, then all of a sudden that license is revoked.
Yes. Another thing that occurred to me while listening to you is that in a sense, absolute idealism could be said to achieve exactly what philosophers of difference set out to achieve, which is to go beyond representation, because the idea in Hegel seems to be that we should consider ideas themselves as real, not merely in a relationship of representation to the world or to the things in themselves, but in a kind of immanent relationship.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, there's a way in which representation goes beyond itself, right? Like that's the idea of the Hegelian idea. That's he has the term idea. And I think the idea is the point at which representation transcends itself or sublates itself.
Yep. Okay. So the next question is about the master and slave dialectic and also unhappy consciousness. So the most frequently cited section of the phenomenology of spirit is almost certainly the master and slave dialectic. You argue that this emphasis has been massively overplayed, perhaps done to death, and instead choose to focus attention on the later figure of the unhappy consciousness. Can you tell us how you account for the repeated overemphasis and why you seem to find Hegel's analysis of the unhappy consciousness so much more provocative and rewarding?
Yeah, why has it happened? I guess it's the influence of Alexander Kojève, for sure, the Russian-French philosopher who gave a course on Hegel in 1930s, attended by Lacan, Merleau-Ponty, and numerous other people. And Kojève's really shaped subsequent thinking about Hegel for a long time. And he takes the master-slave dialectic as his point of departure. And I think it appealed to people. It appealed to Marx. I think it appealed to people in part because it's so well written. I think it's one of the points at which Hegel really he kind of transcends himself. He's usually not the greatest writer. And it's one of these, it's a great story he tells. It's almost like he's a novelist or a short story. It's going to be a short story, I guess. He's telling this story about these two figures struggling against each other. So I almost think there's an aesthetic reason for why people have glommed onto it to such an extent. But the other reason is because I think people like the idea of recognition, and I think they get from the master-slave dialectic the idea that mutual recognition is possible. That is, that that the master and slave can't achieve mutual recognition. They're always in this point of failure of recognition. No, like the slave recognizes the master, but the slave, because the slave is a slave, isn't worthy of recognizing the master. So there's this constant mismatch. But people get from that the idea that if they fail to recognize each other because they're not mutual, and thus Hegel's idea by, you know, implicitly is mutual recognition is the way to go ethically, politically, et cetera. And so I think that's, people like that idea. And I almost think they've written that idea back onto Hegel, and they've seen in master-slave dialectic a way to justify that in terms of his philosophy, but I think is not really there. And I think this idea that a philosophy of, like, making Hegel into a philosopher of recognition, I find just a bizarre thing, but that's the way that he's, you know, especially here in America, that's one of the ways, the central ways in which he's read. So he gets transposed, and it goes on all sides of the philosophical dial. So Judith Butler thinks of him that way. Robert Pippin thinks of him that way. So there's a way in which these disparate figures come together around the idea of recognition. And I think that's the key thing about why master-slave dialectic functions so centrally.
Okay. And you instead seem to really enjoy the figure of the unhappy consciousness. So yeah. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I do. I like that figure, except, I mean, obviously the problem with the figure of the unhappy consciousness is that it doesn't recognize that its unhappiness is also its happiness. And so I guess that would be my only way of twisting that figure. I do like that figure because I think that the understanding the way in which dissatisfaction is central to any satisfaction, that's the Hegelian project, much more than the master-slave dialectic. So you're right. I feel like the movement out of that. So master-slave dialectic is the beginning of that section on, not the exact beginning, but toward the beginning of the section on self-consciousness. Then it goes through stoicism, skepticism, and relies on unhappy consciousness. I think it's one truth about Hegel is that whatever's further along in the book is always more of what he thinks. It's an interesting little key to reading Hegel. Like, if you want to understand what he really thinks, get to the end. But if you want to understand, is he more invested in a position? Is it further along in the book than if he's more invested in it?
Yep. While I was listening, I was just thinking that for me, there are actually many quite beautiful passages in the Phenomenology and passages that ring true at an emotional level, which is, you know, not how people normally think about Hegel. Things like the beautiful soul and the pure heart and all these figures that evoke what it, in a sense, what it feels like to be caught up in something where you are divided against yourself, which is, well, to use an unfortunate word, something that I recognize.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I agree with you. These are great figures. And, you know, that, like, even the name of them, like beautiful soul, seems like how did he think of that? It's just like such an incredible idea. And I think it really gets at something that is true to the way, one of the forms that our subjectivity takes. And oftentimes I, like you, I kind of recognize myself in a lot of these figures, especially beautiful souls. Hard. It's so hard to avoid because the world, certain aspects of the world are in such terrible shape. It's really easy to become the beautiful soul and think, like, just complain about the world and not really recognize oneself in it. And not recognize the way, and I think this is what the beautiful soul doesn't do, not recognize the way in which one's complaints are actually helping to constitute the very thing that one is complaining about.
So that sounds a bit like the logic of hysteria in Freud.
Yeah, I think I think that's right. I think that, you know, it's funny, you said before that Freud, you know, he mentions Hegel, that he doesn't talk about Hegel. He mentions him twice, both times clearly just in reference to other thinkers, and it's clear he never really read him. He never read him at all. And I think that, but if he did, I wonder if he would have seen these figures that he's identifying in neurotic and other kinds of disorders, perverse disorders. I wonder if he would have seen them identified in the Hegelian dialectic. I tend to think that he would have.
Okay. Okay. So my next question's about the usual idea of Hegel's work and the Phenomenology and other works as being progressive, as leading to a kind of ascent. Okay, so you continually stress what you view as the progressive political implications of Hegel's thought, but you severely qualify the usual image of the movement of his dialectic as a progressive one that ascends irreversibly to the supposed security of absolute knowledge. How would you account for this apparent disparity between the usual description of Hegel's thought and your own explication? Isn't it true that Hegel himself consistently insists that we must follow the full development of the dialectic to reach the absolute.
Yeah, he does insist on that. And I guess for me, what I would say is that it's not progressive. And I think I talk about politics as, I think he's a philosopher of emancipation, but I don't think I ever use the word progressive, because I guess for me, Hegel is not that his idea of what emancipation is means discovering something that's already present, we're not creating something that is going to help us get out of something. Like, I think progress is, it's tied to the idea that we can get out of something. And I think Hegel wants to say, we can't really get out of the things that are the ultimate problems of our existence are things that we can't get out of. And that the only solution is to reconcile ourselves to them. And so I guess that, for me, that's the key, that it's not, I think of the politics as emancipatory and leftist, I don't think of it as progressive. I think of it as really discovering something that's intractable and finding a way to reconcile ourselves to it. And that in some way, all the horrors that we've seen politically are the result of not reconciling ourselves to what I call the intractability of contradiction. But I think that's the key for me, that Hegel's not about progressing. I think that's the misunderstanding. And I think, you know, does he himself kind of lead us in that direction? Maybe. But I think, you know, really, if you look at the way his thought works itself out, it's never like the absolute is never this, it's never a progress toward the absolute. It's only because the absolute has to be read retroactively. So we're always, he even says this, that we're always at the point of the absolute. And it's not something to be attained in the sense that we're going forward. It's something to be attained in a kind of recognition, and thus a rewriting or a reconceiving of where we are.
Okay. And so my next question is about probably the aspect of Hegel that I find hardest to keep in my own head consistently. It's the sort of thing that I can understand and then suddenly seem not to understand anymore, which is the relationship between the singular and the universal. So the one note sounded in your explication that seems to resonate strongly with themes of other forms of contemporary theory is that of the singular. But that moment of possible harmony seems to be quickly undermined by your insistence that the movement of the dialectic can only be coherently thought in relationship to universality, which is a notion which has been widely denounced as oppressive and presumptuous and badly need of dismantling. And as I said, this strikes me as the one argument that most readers, listeners, and myself will find the hardest to get their heads around. Can you help us understand the relationship between particularity, singularity, and universality in Hegel?
Sure. So for me, and I think this is true for Hegel, that universality is the thing that lifts us up out of our particularity. So we exist in, we're born into, we're determined into a particularity, whatever, you know, whatever our identity is, our maleness, our ethnic identity, our career identity, all these things that define us as particulars. The universality for him is the thing that allows us to get purchase on that particularity and lifts us out of it. And it gives us a different perspective on it. Like I can, if the universal is something like equality or freedom, I can relate to myself and my particularity in a different way because of that universality. I can think of it differently. And that singularity then is the way that I relate back to my particularity because of universality. So it's always going to be different for everyone. So I think that's where universality is this freeing that then allows me to relate back to my particularity. So rather than just feeling like, oh, I am a man, I can relate to my maleness. Like, oh, I don't really feel like I am that maleness. I feel like I want to reject it totally. And then that would constitute me as singular. So I think that's the trick of universality, that it lifts us up out of our particularity, and then it allows us to relate back to it in a way that defines us as singular.
So in a sense, what's universal is this experience of the failure of identity.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that out of that experience of failure, I think we can derive all the, like, the classic universals of the French Revolution: freedom, equality, and solidarity. That those things are all, like, they're all, they all have their origin in failure, in the failure. Like, we're free because any authority always is at odds with itself and fails, and we're all equal in that failure, and we're all together in that failure. So I think those, you know, those classic universals of the French Revolution are tied to the failure of subjectivity, or the failure of subjectivity and the failure of any substantial authority.
So it's interesting that you mentioned freedom, because another thing that occurs to me is that many commentators of Hegel have seen his philosophy as antagonistic to freedom. Karl Popper, for example, who denounced him as an enemy of the open society, and even more sympathetic commentators like Adorno and so on seem to think that there is something intrinsically totalitarian or oppressive or restrictive about Hegel and his embrace of the absolute. So I'd be interested if you could tell us a little bit more about your understanding of freedom from an Hegelian point of view.
Yeah, so I think those two are completely wrong, and I take them both up a little bit in the book. And I for me, freedom from a Hegelian point of view is precisely that ability to be oneself in absolute otherness, so that you don't. In a way, it's an ability to lose oneself. That you are yourself only when you're in this. You can be yourself in what's absolutely other, and so you're not confined to what your identity is. So it's a little bit tied to this, what I was talking about earlier about universality. That it's that freedom for Hegel is breaking out of identity. It's getting out of what my society or what my birth has made me. And in that way, I think he's still connected to the Kantian idea of freedom, because for Kant, it's the moral law that allows us to break out in that way. It's just for Hegel, it's not necessarily the moral law. It's our ability, I would say it's something like our ability to love that makes us free, or our ability to grasp our own failure, which I think is consonant with our ability to love.
Okay. And so my next question, which will probably be my last, or no, rather the second last, is an attempt to bring Hegel into the present. Your book repeatedly made me think of one very prominent name in contemporary politics, and that name was Donald Trump. I thought of it while reading about Hegel's refusal of the friend-enemy opposition, about the implied lesson of Freud's theory of death drive, that the unconscious causes subjects to work against their own good, and in your argument that Hegel's work exposes the rhetoric of the rebel as a form of conformism. All these themes seem to converge in one way or another in the last few days in your president's sudden declaration of war against what he apparently considers a foreign virus. Perhaps we could wind up the interview with some thoughts on how the work of Hegel might equip activists and theorists responding to the age of Trump shock.
Yeah, it's good. I think that Trump is the great anti-Hegelian figure for the reasons that you just pointed out. And he's in love with the friend-enemy distinction. He even has to try to create it out of a virus, which clearly has no enemy. And I think the virus is itself a Hegelian phenomenon, because it's a point at which life is attacking life, when life is at odds with itself. And I was thinking about, I was talking to some friends of mine about this, and it's interesting that a war or an external conflict with enemies and actual people is always good ground for the right and for conservatism, whereas the interaction with a natural disaster or with a plague is always, I think, a great opportunity for the left, that we're on leftist terms. And this is why you wouldn't know this, but here in America, Fox News has been so reluctant to even credit that the virus is actual. They just want to say it's the flu, it's nothing big, it's don't worry about it, keep going on cruises, etc. Because they understand, I think, implicitly that the virus is bad news for them. That it's good news for someone like Bernie Sanders. I mean, it happened too late for him, I think, but it's good news for that kind of idea of what politics means. And I think it does also show the Hegelian nature of even being itself, because life itself, that life doesn't just go along, that there are these points at which it destroys itself. And the virus is an interesting case of that. Unfortunately, I have a chronic lung ailment, so it would be if the virus gets me, it will really be life destroying itself. So it's not. I like the idea theoretically, but I'm hoping that practically I won't have to realize that.
Well, I hope that's the case too. Okay, so I suppose we have taken enough of your time. I'm supposed to end by asking you what you're working on now.
Okay, so we talked about universality. It's interesting that I'm working on a book called Universality and Identity Politics. So I'm really fleshing out the idea of universality from Hegel, giving it a slightly different twist. But it was really my work with in this book, in Emancipation After Hegel, that got me thinking about this and got me to think about the problems with identity politics and also how that's thrown around as an attack on the left against things that aren't which get attacked as identity politics, which I think actually are universalist projects in disguise. So part of the book is uncovering the universal where we wouldn't see it, and then the other part of it is just claiming universality as itself a leftist project. So the idea is that the left is always universalist and the right or conservatism is always particularist, and this is really the fundamental struggle that's going on. And I think, you know, today we see it right now, like the right's response to the virus is particularist, like give money to certain people and not think about the whole. And the left's response is at least impressively has been universalist.
Well, in particular, give $1 trillion to the stock market.
Yeah. Exactly. Yep. Completely particularist response.
Yep. Okay, well, I think we've reached the end of this interview, which I enjoyed immensely, and thank you very much for your time, Todd McGowan.
Oh, Bill, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.